bright sun, so I could read this. I printed out a big font so I could see it, but even then, it's like, no, she's kind of no, I think
you can leave out the bio.
I think Owen sort of said, oh, Bruce knows him better anyway, so.
2 minutes.
To charge for tickets.
Uh-huh.
Thanks very much for coming on, Steve. It's very appreciated.
Right. I haven't actually prepared.
I could have gathered that with you. If anybody can hoot me, you can. So, don't worry, I'll
stop. I proved I was in what I had. I just didn't know we were going to be here.
You've got a lovely broad title.
I've already changed.
You've got everything in the title.
I didn't write that shit.
Sure. I don't know who did.
Not me. What's heritage?
So what do you want me to call it? Just that bit?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came from, but I thought it was very long.
That's nothing to do with me. I don't even know what heritage means.
It's on the programme, so
okay.
I don't know.
You just call it that as well.
Features, that's yeah. Nice and straightforward.
Shut down.
Such a big audience for the first of this year's AGI Scotland EO seminars. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Bruce Gittings. I could wear my hat as chair of AGI Scotland and mention to you that not only is this seminar series supported by AGI Scotland, but also by the Edinburgh Conservatory, which is the umbrella for GIS and remote sensing here in the university. The AGI, if you don't know who the AGI are, Association for Geographic Information, champions the value that links that are the links between geography and information for the benefit of economy, business, and the individual. You can tell I just cut and pasted that from somewhere, can't you? Anyway, so do think about joining AGI if you're not a member. As students, you get free membership. It's a really useful network to be part of, and enjoy that. Also enjoy the refreshments. So if you need to recharge glasses, bottles, or whatever, there's lots of refreshments at the back. So grab one now. You've got 30 seconds before I finish speaking. I should tell you about fire exits. The room is pretty full. If something happens, we don't intend to shoot. If the fire alarm goes off, it isn't a practice. I would probably literally just follow me out the door because we'll all be going the same direction. It's basically out into the main hall and out the front entrance is the quickest and most effective way to leave. Okay, so we've got a seminar this afternoon, and I'll introduce Charles just in a second. The format is he'll talk for sort of 40-50 minutes. And then we have AGI's Geo Drinks over in the library bar and TV, to which you're all welcome, and we absolutely encourage people to come along to continue discussion, questions, and so on. To our speaker, Charles Kennelly. Charles sent me a bio earlier this afternoon. He tells me he's worked in the GIS industry for 2 decades, which I kind of did know. I didn't know that he'd started life as a digitizer, so he's gone from probably the most lowly job in the industry right up to the top, which is great. But working both in local government and for his current company, which is Esri UK, he's been involved in a whole range of design, development, deployment and management of successful systems. I think there's few people actually in the industry in Britain who has the range of experience that Charles has, so we're really, really lucky to have him.
I think you're telling them that I'm old.
Well, I'm as old as you are, so I'm going to be very careful saying things like that. So, anyway. Charles is going to talk to us today about GIS features, which is something he's very good at crystal ball gazing. It's always fun to hear what's in that crystal ball. So I think without further ado, I will hand over to you, Charles.
Thank you.
And the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
So I haven't actually prepared slides. I don't
quite know what we're going to talk about. I've got a rough idea. I probably shouldn't start drinking. So to start talking about the future, let's look at the past. So we're most people here involved in GIS in some way, I presume. And you are involved in GIS because you think you might get a job out of it, or you like it, you're interested in it, you think it's an exciting technology and it can do good things. So my actual previous career, I was actually a DJ before GIS, and I stumbled into it. I decided I wanted a proper job, and I didn't want to be 15 hanging around 18-year-olds, basically, so I wanted to change my life. And I started working with local authority, and after about a month, my boss said to me, "You like new things, don't you?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he sent me to a room to work with something called GIS. I'd never heard of it before. I had dropped out of geography at school. I hated my geography teacher. And within 2 weeks, I knew what I was going to do with my life, because I just found this technology that I couldn't believe I didn't know about. And I'm trained in silicon chip design, basically. So with an IT background, I love technology, I have never heard of this technology. And the question is, why? Why not? If it's so good, why haven't I? If it's so good, why do you need a special course to learn about it? So my son has just finished from Edinburgh University doing an IT degree. Part of that degree, he did a module on database design, and at no point in that module did he learn about spatial relationship. There is no agreed way, standard way of drawing a spatial relationship on an engineered relationship diagram. Why? This technology is so brilliant. Why is it still not mainstream? And the question that has always bothered me is, why is GIS special? Why is it separate? Why is it not used by everybody? And that sort of really bothered me for a long time. And I think the reason is, most of the computer systems that we work with today, with the banking systems, insurance companies, engineering companies, and so on, those systems were designed and codified in the 70s. So late 60s through the 70s, early 80s, that's when people moved from their old paper-based systems and their old manual people-based systems to computer systems. And at the time when this was happening, in the late 60s, early 70s through the 70s, computers, they would have built this room, and they wouldn't have done very much processing for filling the street. They would have generated a lot of heat, but they would not have done very much work. And early computer systems, they simply could not handle geographic information. It was too complex to work with. Which meant that when people were developing the data management techniques and how do you turn a manual system into a computerized system, they didn't use geography at that point because they couldn't use geography at that point. So if you think about it, the simplest piece of geographic information is a dot on a map. But in order for that dot to be relatively accurate in the UK, you need quite a long number. To be down to a metre, you need how many digits?
4 or 5.
In the UK. 12.
Sorry,
in the UK. 12.
Oh, it depends whether you're talking lat long or
12 digits.
East, east, north, east.
Just to say where this dot is. Okay? And if you want to know that it's within the British National Grid, to know it's only 12 digits, then you need some more information, even with the dot. Early computers were designed to handle ones and zeros, like modern ones, but they didn't handle many ones and zeros. They could store somebody's salary, and they could store somebody's name. They could tell that salary was bigger or less than another one. They could tell somebody's name was before or after somebody else's in the alphabet, relatively easily. But they couldn't store and manage this sort of information, especially if the information you're using was representing a boundary and it had 10,000 of those, or even 100 of those. They simply could not be seen. The relationships between shapes are not simple relationships. It's not bigger or smaller. If a dot in the shape, it can be inside, it can be outside, it can be close, but is this closer than that? It's hard to tell. The relationships are complex. So basically, if you go into an organization like an engineering firm, if you went in there in the sort of 80s, you go into the Forestry Commission in the UK, which I went into, you saw the computer system over here and the maps over there. And the maps were in a cabinet. They were paper maps. They had not been computerized. And the only reason they had not been computerized is computers were not fast enough. So when people designed systems, they didn't use geography because they couldn't use geography. The previous systems that they were translating from manual systems to computers did involve geography, or else there wouldn't be maps lying around. I've worked with quite a lot of utility companies, and I remember talking to somebody at Scottish Power when they had a problem in a town in Wales, and he wished he had the old days where he just had a big map on the wall, because he used to use that to manage his teams. He would go to the map on the wall and he would move people around using this paper map with pins in it. Then they move to the computers that are left behind. And that's why GIS is special. The processing power required to do this has only existed in the last 20 years. And it's only existed at the scale that we needed in the last 10 years. And it's only become cheap and easy and convenient to do in the last 5 years. You know, the iPhone in my jacket over there didn't exist 10 years ago. Didn't exist, I think, about 8 years ago. You know, these things that we take around that did not exist in the processing power we take around that did not exist. And therefore, GIS, my rough estimation, is it has lagged behind mainstream IT by about 30 years. And it's only now getting to the point where it should be getting and can be used in everything. You see, internet companies like Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, they have location now involved in everything. You Google use it for all their searching, and so on. They've developed incredible technologies around it because of the need for it. But these technologies have only been developed since the internet grew up, and since they were tracking lots and lots of individuals. And the price of recording location, the price of processing location, and working with it has plummeted. But it's still not got to where it needs to be. We'll talk about that in a second. So the technology has ramped up. We now can do the things at the level we should have been able to do them 30 years ago. But all the systems that we work with have already been designed. I go in and I work with banks, or I work with insurance companies, or I work with utilities companies, and I look at the systems that they've built. And inside my head, a little voice is saying, they built it wrong, they need to get rid of everything, and build it again with spatial relationships at the core. But very few banks want to delete their entire systems. They will not build spatial at the core of their businesses. So we need to integrate with these things, and we need to slowly win over this work. The other thing I've noticed is technology is accelerating incredibly fast. I'm just going to throw up a slide. Who knows what that is? So I'm obviously just using things that I have lying around. And forgive them for being heavy things. I just want to hint at a few stuff. Obviously, I don't have like map info slides or open source slides because that would be odd. Just even in the areas of like in the last few years, just surveying. This is how surveying was done 5 years ago, 6 years ago. You went out, you put this thing in the ground, and somebody. That's how you did it. This one is quite an advanced one, and so on. But we now have people doing this sort of stuff and getting incredible accuracy with it. So if I go and look at. And this has only happened very, very recently. This is something done by Vera, who are the Food and Environment Rural something. And they flew a drone over a field. They took some pictures of the field. This is a potato crop. Which is being planted by a company who make crisps, like you're eating from the back of the room. And they basically, if I go into the layers here, flew that in an afternoon, and then they were able to work out where the potatoes are. And then the bit that they're working on now is a little tool where you come along and you say, take this area, and they will just basically run and execute, they'll execute something against that that will tell them what the crop is going to be, and where they need to plant things and so on. To do that level of detail, to survey every single potato plant, was not possible even 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You could do it if you went around and took individual pictures, but basically you would have had to measure every potato plant. They're now doing that on an afternoon, and that's the scale of change that we've seen. And there's a range of tools available to us now, which just work in a way that we're only starting to understand how to make use of them in geography. So this is, I presume people are familiar with big data and big data techniques. Yeah, happy to talk about big data stuff? I'm just going to say yes. So we've seen a real growth in the use of big data analysis. So big data tools came about because of the internet and the need for processing at huge volumes. Your Yahoo, your Microsoft, you want to process and understand your customer base, your Twitter, and you want to know what's going on. The sort of tools that we use traditionally could not cope with those data volumes. So in the last decade, computing power has gone up about 100 times. So a huge increase. But the ability to process data has gone up about 1,000 times. So it's not, it's, and that ability to process data has gone up because people understand how to manipulate data in better ways. And a lot of it comes from splitting a problem into parts and then spreading that load across multiple machines. Computers are cheaper, so we can have 50 of them or 100 of them or 1,000 of them doing the work. So people have started developing techniques that break data into chunks, spread it out, and do things with it. And a whole sort of new type of data processing has emerged in the last decade. And we're only starting to understand how to make use of it in the geography space now. So as an example, this is what we've learned with trying to use big data type analysis on geographic data. So if you imagine the white dots, that's a big data set spread out across the whole UK, every address in the UK, for example. And the little orange dot, which hopefully you can see at the back, that is an address that I want to see what's close to it, or a point I want to find out what's close to it. So if you're working with some big data tools, the things like Hadoop framework, where you spread the load over multiple machines, you analyze the data, you basically spread the data across multiple machines. So you take your big data set and spread it across multiple machines. Then you take your little dot and you put it onto every machine. And you say on each machine, is that dot close to these? Is it close to these? You do it in parallel, and then you bring the answers together and you have an answer. The other thing you can do is you can take data and ask self-referential questions. So split the data up into chunks and ask questions like a hotspot analysis. So hotspot analysis, heat mapping, that's really what's close to me, bearing in mind what's around it. It's a very easy question to ask. You can spread it out across multiple machines, and you get your answer. But the problem with GIS we found is, imagine you want to take everything in the UK and compare it against everything else in the UK. So some of our utility customers, for example, they want to take every building outline in the UK, and they want to take all the power lines in the UK, and they want to tell when the power lines are too close to the buildings, because then there's safety issues and they need to manage that. And they need to update that information regularly. If you take spatial data and you break it up and spread it across multiple machines, and then you take more spatial data, big data, and spread it out again, it is unlikely that the data on this machine in white is actually next to the one that's in yellow. That yellow one might be actually for over there, because in order to spread them out onto the right machines, you need to know they're in the same place. So to do this problem, you've got to solve this problem. You've got to work out where the data is in order to do it. And you end up with this, which we've seen happen with our customers. They're taking computing tools, and they're these modern computing tools engineered for large-scale data, and they're trying to apply those computing tools to the geographic data, and they're hitting problems because they weren't engineered with geographic data in mind. They were engineered with the problem the person who wrote it was trying to fix. So, for example, there's a technology called Flume, which we're using now for real-time analysis. Flume is, imagine you've got a data center with 100,000 servers in it, and you need to know what's happening with them all. So you need to get the log files of every single machine. So somebody wrote some software called Logflume, which would pull in all of the logs into one place and have a look at them. It was engineered to gather information into one place. Big data type analysis like this, the sort of Hadoop distributed processing approach, was engineered to take certain tasks and spread them out over multiple machines. Geographic data does not necessarily work in this way. So even though we've moved into a 100 times the computing power of 10 years ago, even though things that were simple, sorry, that were hard to do at the start of the development of GIS have become easier, we still have the problem where geographic data can break ordinary IT. That's the interesting thing. Now, I got into GIS originally because I thought it was an incredible technology. It's the only technology that I could imagine that can help us understand the effect of global warming and the sort of competing needs of a densely populated island. So I used to work in, where did I put my pen? I used to work for a local authority in North Wales, and that local authority had a highways department, and they would design, you see that? Okay. Yeah. They would design roads. And what they did when they designed the road is, imagine here's the village, this is based on a real example, here's the village that the old road is going through, and they want to put a bypass around it. So they would design that road, and they would say, okay, here's where the new road needs to be. And they analysed this road on one factor, and that factor was cost. And this side of the town was old industrial land, and this side of the town was ancient woodland. It's cheaper to buy an ancient field than it is to buy an ancient factory. Okay. So somebody owns the ancient factory, a business in it, they don't want to sell it. So they had an algorithm that used one factor that basically found a nice piece of the land infuriated. Because what I knew from working with the GIS department was here, there was actually a mineral deposit that was very valuable. So forget the environmental factor, they have just damaged the potential income for this area by making it unable to, you know, the mineral deposit could not be accessed anymore because there's a road on the top of it. So their simple focus on one factor was very limiting and led to the wrong answer. What I wanted to happen was, as the guy was designing the road, he saw, here's the cost of building the road, here's the cost of bringing in the material to build it, here's the cost of the land that you're going to need to buy, but here's the environmental impact on this. This is the biodiversity impact. This is the impact on the local economy in terms of the lack of... I wanted them to balance multiple factors. And no other technology in GIS can do this in an easy way. If you want to integrate multiple types of data and make informed decisions, you need GIS. But to do that, you need access to every data set which affects it, and more importantly, you need access to the brain that can understand it, the intelligence behind it. So for example, in North Wales, there's a project that was done called Beetle, and it's all about fragmentation of habitat. So you imagine you've got a habitat of 10 hectares. It could sustain red squirrels if it's the right type of habitat. But if you break it down by putting a road through it, 2 5-hectare plots cannot sustain that same population. But if you put a worse habitat in between that they can transition through, then it's okay, they can live there. That's quite complex understanding. How do you get somebody designing a road to benefit from that level of understanding? What you need to be able to do is share not just the raw data. So we see a huge increase in people publishing open data, people can analyze, but we don't see huge benefit necessarily coming directly from it, because without the intelligence and the understanding of that data, how can you make sense of it? So we need a way of publishing that intelligence and the analysis and the interpretation of that data in a way that it can make sense of. This is the level of functionality we need, and the technology is only getting to the point where that is possible. So that's the background. So now let's talk about what we can do with these things and where they are now. So just to give you an idea of what sort of things are happening there, this is a graph. In Esri, we created a thing called ArcGIS Online that we released in 2012. And it's like an online mapping platform. And its job was to just do the basics. It wasn't trying to do all of GIS, it was just trying to do the basics and make it accessible to as many people as possible, as cheaply as we could manage it. And it's been ridiculously successful, which I'll talk about why in a second. But just to show you the sort of scale that we're now working at. This graph is showing, this is a Monday morning, 20th of the 7th, this is an American graph, so the dates are wrong. And what it's showing you here is, this is how many requests were made of our base mapping system. So we supply base maps for the world, and that number there is basically getting towards 500 million maps were made in a Monday morning. That's the normal sort of load that we see. Just for reference, in 2012, we did 1 billion base maps out of our system. And on a Monday, on an ordinary day, we're doing 500 million. That's the level of growth we've seen. And then this happened. And it got up to 4 billion map requests in one day. This is the number of unique visitors that hit the site. On a Monday, we had that number. And we peaked at nearly 25 million people hitting the site in one day. Can anyone guess what caused that? You look at the date and the popularity. It's Pokemon. Pokemon Go was released. Somebody created a map called Pokevision. It doesn't work anymore, but they made a map called Pokevision where you could see where Pokemon were. And they used our base maps for doing that. And the reason they used our base maps wasn't because they liked Ezra or anything, it was just because they were there and they could access them. And they were cheap and they were convenient and they could make use of it, so they used it. It nearly broke our entire system. But it didn't. It actually kept working, which amazed us more than them. And it scaled up to these sort of levels. And it was incredibly, it was the best app for 1 week. I was cool. And then it got turned off. But it just shows you that with the sort of technology available to us now, we can scale up mapping to a huge degree. So in the UK, there are 410, 420 local authorities, for example. And every single one of those local authorities has an Ordnance Survey liaison officer, whose job it is to get data from the Ordnance Survey. So the Ordnance Survey is the national mapping agency here. And They get the data in, they process that data, and they create the maps for their GIS department and for their organisation. And 420 people across the UK did that job. They were all doing exactly the same job. They were taking the data from the organisation, from the Ordnance Survey, loading it into their own database and publishing it to their own organisation. It's the same data, maybe for different areas, but basically the same data, same process. That's a huge barrier to making use of stuff. The cost of having everybody in those organisations, the frequency with which they can update it, the speed with which it works, were all limiting factors. And if you look at, you know, we make our money by selling people technology to make use of things and to do GIS, and we need people who understand GIS and can get the benefits out of it. What we don't want them doing is loading data. That's a waste of time. What they need to be doing is analysis and showing people how roads can be built appropriately. So I got into GIS for what it could achieve. I could see how it could make road planning better. I could see how it could make the understanding of climate change and our impact upon it better. But I ended up becoming a deep techie. I ended up learning hardcore programming, having to understand how to scale machines to high levels, how to design systems. I became an IT person, a very, very dedicated, well-trained-ish IT person. And what I wasn't really was a GIS person. I was helping other people do it, but primarily, in order to do that job, I ended up becoming very deep into the technology. What I'm seeing happening now, and what I think the future is the technology's got to the point where it can do this stuff. There's still some lessons to be learned, there's still some things we need to do, like how do you use big data tools or create new big data tools to do higher volume geographic things? How do we bring that geographic understanding to bear on the rest of humanity? But we're a long way down the line, and we can start playing with it and enjoying it and doing things with it and showing the value of it. So, this leads into a project I've been working on for the last few years. And my mouse skills on this thing won't be very good, bear with me. So, we decided that what we wanted to do was see how far we could go with giving more advanced GIS to ordinary people. And I've logged in as the wrong person, so we'll log in as the right person. And we wanted to look not at the areas of the publishing of geographic information. That, to a large degree, has been solved. Google showed us how to do that. The city maps, the wide publication, having good data. I remember sitting in our office when Google Earth comes out. People remember Google Earth being released. The first reaction of Esri was panic, that this company had done something so much better than ours. And then we went through the grief cycle, we became defensive. And we started to say, but our technology's better than theirs, our 3D's better than theirs. It wasn't, but we thought it was. But what we didn't have was content. With Google Earth, you could look at your house, and you could look at where you were going to go on holiday. With us, you could look at how nice the 3D technology was. Nobody wants to do that. They needed content. It was a lesson we learned. So the publication of things, you just saw with Pokemon, we can confidently publish to 20 million people in a day, we can confidently serve up billions of base maps, we can go beyond that easily. So the publication of it, of geographic data, the dissemination of it, that's happening. But the more advanced stuff is not. So we just log into this. So what we wanted to do was say, how can we take the, stick with my password. Okay. So, we wanted to see how do you make the creation and management of geographic data easy. What we wanted to do was have the man designing the road make a better decision. That's what we wanted to achieve. Now, in order to make that road and make a proper decision, what he needs access to is other people's data. He needs to know about mineral data, environmental data, 3D landscape, building materials, road information. He needs access to all of that. He also needs to be able to access the intelligence behind that data. What happens if I break this habitat in two? What happens if I change this land use from this type to that type? So he needs access to that. But he also needs to be able to create the data in a way where questions can be asked of it. So the first problem we had to solve is, how do you make the creation of geographic data easy? Not easy to the point where you don't need to be a road engineer. Not easy to the point where you don't need to be a forester, but easy to the point where you don't need to be a GIS professional to understand it. No ordinary person asking questions of geography should have to understand topology. They should not have to understand slivers and overlaps and holes and lines that are meant to meet but don't quite meet. It should just work. How do you do that? And so we basically have been experimenting for about 2 years on how we do this. And the most basic version of it is here. So the first job is how do you make data easy to create, easy to manage, and so on. And this is where I see the future of GIS, which is about making it properly usable by the public. And this has happened in some areas. So sat-nav, for example, used to be very, very hard. It was expensive to work out where you were. It was expensive to get the data to tell what was around. It was very expensive. You used to spend hundreds of pounds on keeping a sat-nav up to date with the latest motorways and everything else. Now we expect it for free. Everybody uses sat-nav to the point where we don't know it used to be GIS. It's just sat-nav. And so it can happen in this way. You can make a technology convenient and usable enough for people to benefit and society to be changed. So let's just look at this. Here is some data. This is a land registry in purple, and the ordnance survey background data in grey. Can you see that okay on that? Okay. So I want to come into that data, and I want to make a shape. So I'm going to create it, and I'm going to make a shape. I'm going to make it here. First thing, I can't create self-intersection. Almost every web editing thing you do will allow you to create self-intersections in the data, which don't work. They break the databases, and you can't analyze them. So there's no box saying, popping up saying, you've just created a self-intersection, please undo it. It's just gently nudging you into it. So I finished my shape, I now have a shape. Now I'm going to make another shape. This data is data about property. And the rules behind this data is it can't overlap. But it's very easy to make it overlap. So I'm just going to double click, and the rules are applied. It doesn't tell me they're not, it just gently flashes something up. So if I make another shape, like this, it just gently sorts it out. Behind the scenes, this is doing full topological analysis. It's cracking the data, it's dealing with slivers and holes and all these sort of things that are below the tolerance we need to worry about, and it's applying the rules. If I want to do something like get rid of something, I subtract it. So I'm just going to actually put it here. So I'm just going to subtract the shape, this, and I have a hole. If I do this, it lets me subtract that. If I select over here like this, and I add some data to it like this, that happens. If I add another shape over here, in this case we've said that the data can be multi-part data, so if I look at what I selected, that's one shape I've just made. So it makes it very easy to play with the data I've created. But I'm casually playing with this data, it's auditing everything I do, and it's also, if I make a mistake, that's how you do it. This is all running in a web browser, nothing else, but a web browser talking to an online GIS service. All the intelligence is in the browser itself running in real time, so I get the feedback. So we had to solve the problem of understanding technology, and we had to understand the problem of user interface. I'll give you a small example of what we've learned from user interface. So if we were using this on an iPad or a tablet, and I do this, one problem we have is your finger gets in the way of the dots. So this is how we solve that. We basically have an offset magnifying glass, which also avoids me having to zoom in on the data to see more detail. So it's just by, we gave people access to this, and we watched them do it, ordinary people, not GIS people. And we watched sort of mistakes they made. One of my favorite lessons we learned was how to split a shape in two. So let me just create a shape. So I make the first part here. And then I'm going to add to that shape like this. So here's one shape, and I want to split it. The way every GIS system I've ever seen works is we want to split a shape and draw a line across it like that. Now you and I, as humans, know that that shape, this bit and this bit belong together. We just know that instinctively. But for the computer to do that with an algorithm to work it out, there's actually quite a lot of math to work out they probably belong together. And if I was to split the shape like this, that direction, you and I don't know if that's meant to be on this half or that half. So something as simple as just splitting a shape can become a barrier to ordinary users of the system. The way we fixed that was by watching somebody and they basically told us the answer. They said, well, what I want to do is that I want to basically enclose the shape. That's how I split it. I split polygon with a polygon. And it's just obvious when you see it, but to a GIS person it's not. So we've had to learn all these sort of lessons. And we've put a lot of work into doing it, like things like if I want to reshape, it knows that that's a shared boundary. So it will, hopefully, move the shared boundary. If I want to do a new vertex, I drag it like that. If I want to delete something, I don't want to right-click because I'm on a tablet, so I just drag it to the bin and I delete it. And if I do something stupid like do that, it knows to cut it off. And those green dots mean topology has been built, so it's now a shared relationship, and so on. So there's all these little simple things we do, and suddenly we've got an editing approach that can be used by somebody who doesn't understand topology. This works with lines and points and polygons, and we've thought through the various rules and how to express those rules. So you need a GIS person to put it together, but you don't need a GIS person to use it. So that's the basic editing approach. Let's think about where we can go next with that. So if I go back to here, and I think, I am now a property developer, and I want to build some new houses. I've built some houses, I've sold them all, I've made a lot of money out of it, now I want to build some more houses. I need permission to build the houses. So this is an example of a system where we built some rules into the editor. So in this case, I'm going to create something, and I'm going to say, I want to build a property here, this. And it says, that's okay, I'm just going to say yes to that. Try again. It's very hard in this house. I've just applied permission to the local authority to build there. Now, I'm making so much money, I want to do some more, so I'm going to go down here. And instantly, it tells me I can't. So now I'm going to go north, and it says, I can't. And what's happening here is every time we click that mouse, it's doing a constraints check. It's going to find if there's any data that will stop me doing and modify my behavior. Imagine that red shape is being broadcast by the local authority, and the builder is interacting with it over the web. There's a number of things happening there. If the local authority changes the local plan or what's allowed or not allowed, that can be instantly relayed to people. But when they've entered that shape, the local authority has been notified that somebody's interested. Somebody's thinking about here. So they can say, well, we need extra protection in that area, or maybe there's an opportunity here. The geography is mediating a conversation between public sector and private sector. And they can simply update their store of information, and whoever interacts with it basically changes as they go. That's a new way of working. That's a really hard process at the moment. There's a whole system in the UK built around constraints analysis and checks on what's possible. We can actually do it in real time. We're going to start work soon with an organization where, imagine you've got your little property and you want to put a conservatory on the back of it. And as you draw the conservatory, the system's going to say to you, you're within a meter of your neighbor, so you need planning permission. Move it to the left and you'll just need building control. Or that's too big compared to the rest of your house, so you're going to need this sort of permission. Or, and so on and so on. But as you draw, so by the time you finish drawing, you've made a better decision, and the local authority knows what's coming. Or they know that they've stopped you making the application before you ever did. It's just a new way of working, enabled by geography being made easy. Another example is, let's look at, this is a farm, and what we've done is we've built this language that allows you to express geographic relationships and interactions and more complex interactions and execute them as you go. The computing power running inside this browser on this laptop is such that we can do things that we would have needed a server to do 10 years ago, and we can do them in real time. And working through this project, we almost sort of stumbled across the fact that this doesn't need to be an analysis that we run after the fact. We can do it as people are working. And once you get over that and realize the power of computing, you can do amazing things. So it doesn't come out very well in here, but let me just try and show you. If I select this field, first I'm going to select that shape and delete it. And I'm going to select this field, look at its properties. And you probably can't see that this is in yellow, but what it's telling you is it's income potential for that field. If you use Excel, and you type into Excel a number, 100, it shows up in the cell. If you type in the name, it shows in the cell. If you put an equal sign before it, open a bracket, and put a formula in there, it doesn't store the value, it stores the evaluation. That's something we're all comfortable with. What we've done is we've embedded evaluations into every attribute of a GIS. And those evaluations can execute geographic analysis in real time, provide feedback, to change people's behavior and form. So, in this case, I've selected the field, and it's telling me the income potential is £2,461 because it's a wheat crop. If I change that wheat crop to sugar beet, it tells me my income potential is way higher because sugar beet's more valuable. If I tell it that I've been out and surveyed it and it's only 10% damaged, it's going to recalculate that. That's a nice, simple calculation. But if I come out and think, right, for biodiversity reasons, what I'm going to do is I am going to create a water feature. I'm going to put some pond in here so I get a different type of light, wildlife. So I'm going to get water, and I'm going to put it on this map. And what it'll do is it'll tell me that's great, you're getting a nice water feature, but you're losing this much income. And the next stage of this is where we put the multiple factors. We say increasing biodiversity and these grants available to you against the loss of crop revenue. And we do it as the person's creating the data. That changes behaviour, and it changes behaviour as people are interacting with it. And we've been talking about this approach with a number of people, and the ideas that are coming through are just incredible. But how far you can take and apply GIS. It's not GIS. There will always be a need for experts sitting in a room who've got access to very powerful tools doing advanced analysis. But the change to society that GIS can make comes from making it useful, as we've seen with SatNav. And that's what the challenge is how do you make this stuff usable? What we've shown you here was possible 2 years ago. It was possible 5 years ago. It was probably possible before that. Maybe not in a lightweight browser, but it's very possible. But for most people in GIS, this sort of way of working is actually new, that you can distribute it out to so many people. And it's not the technology which has got in the way. It's the ideas, the thinking of it. What I'm starting to see happen, we work with startups quite a lot. And I'm starting to see startups coming on, and they don't know that GIS is hard. They just get on with it, come up with these brilliant ideas. And the technology supports that. And it's the non-GIS world is where I'm seeing the innovation coming from. That's what's driving things forward, because people don't realise that they should stop and learn about spatial relationships. They're just doing it, and they're doing it with the technology that's available today. So, basically, we've come a long way, and we're going to go further. Now, just to finish up, I think I've got my slides. I'm not going to go through this at all. This is something I put together about 2 years ago to show it was the history of the next 25 years. I was using it to make some points about the state of the GIS industry. In the UK. And it just steps through. Because it's the future, it's okay to be rude about people, basically, because it hasn't happened. And that's what this was about. It's basically a timeline of how GIS is going to go through. And what in doing it, what I learned was there's a huge potential harm with this technology as well. The level of intrusion in people's lives that's possible thanks to location information is huge. We can track everybody in the UK in real time if we want to. And the technology to do that is here now, and the technology to do that cheaply and easily will be here within 10 years. Like every single person can be tracked down to sub-meter accuracy. Analysis, like I've just shown you, can be run in real time. The big data tools and AI tools which are there, they can learn behaviours and predict them way before we can. We think we're all individuals, we think we're making decisions for rational reasons, but we're not. We're making them for environmental and marketing and all sorts of reasons, and they can be predicted in many ways. It's quite scary when you think it through. When I was putting this through, I started thinking about the impact on society of tagging offenders as they get released, which we do at the moment. I was thinking about the sort of technology which is coming along. I think about, in the future, the government saying about mandatory tagging of people. Obviously, society, hopefully, will react against that. Just because it's technically possible doesn't mean it will happen. So it is technically possible to arm everybody in the UK. America's proven that. But as a society, we decided not to go with that. We decided to moderate it. The technology can do this, but we've got to decide how to use it. So I expect that if there is a proposal for citizen ID scheme, it will soon be abandoned afterwards. But then the demands to track migrants will be there, or ex-convicts will be there. So this societal impact is quite high. But if you take it through, I'm just going to skip through. I'm happy to share this with people if they're interested in it. It's got all sorts of stuff in it. Like, for example, GIS-specific hardware. We've got GPUs, which are graphical processing units, which have proven to be very powerful for certain types of analysis. Think about if we start building in geographic analysis into hardware, how much faster analysis can become. And some of the analysis we can't do in real time today, we will be able to. And if you saw the Microsoft Ignite conference last week, they were talking about things called field programmable gateways, which are silicon chips that you can program, physically change the hardware by just burning in the software. So it should be possible to take some sort of advanced buffering analysis and burn it into hardware and get those performance things. And the price of these things are pennies. So the processing power is going to go up. You see what's happening with cars at the moment. You can see the level of automation coming out of cars. Start thinking that through to its sort of logical conclusion. The ability to capture location, the sub-centimeter accuracy at low power, is almost upon us. The ability to embed that into every device is almost upon us. The ability to track that in real-time decisions is almost upon us. So we will see things happening like, for example, skip ahead. That was about SAP finally understanding GIS is worthwhile. Skip ahead. Does I'm willing to share it with everybody. But this is, for example, every brick could afford to have a location chip in it, tell when it's shipped, and broadcast that information in the building. It would be that cheap. We did some work with a company who shipped pallets, wooden pallets around the UK. Wooden pallets cost them about 10 pence each. So if they have got to embed something in those pallets, this is the economy of scale they work at, and that thing costs a penny, it's too much money for them. So, but the stuff is getting cheaper and cheaper. That was just a joke that, I don't know if you know Jack Dangerman from Esri, the first question people ask is what happens when he dies. He'll be cloned, so it's okay. This is a joke about cartographers being the best paid job in the UK. And some of the things that when I wrote this 2 years ago seemed farcical and future, like a national drone network having a live map of the UK. That's actually starting to happen. It's incredible. But imagine you've got all the cars out there, all the behaviour there, and the DVLA could easily decide to impose a speed limit from centrally. 70 miles an hour, no car can go above it. They can probably start moderating that speed limit centrally. They could probably start having a transport network that works out using AI and everything else, where people are going to go, where you intend to go. You leave the house in the morning, you're going to go to Heathrow to get a flight somewhere. They can slow you down by a minute, speed a few other people up by a minute, make sure 350 people turn up at Heathrow when the plane's about to take off. So we don't need timetabling. You can actually moderate and link these systems to get in this way. Trains will leave the platform when the people arrive on the platform because the people have arrived on the platform because the train's ready to go. That's what spatial technology can do, and we're going to see that. And thankfully, quite a few of you are a lot younger than me, so you've got an opportunity to moderate this and learn from it and get it adopted in appropriate ways. So I see the future of GIS is where it becomes genuinely ubiquitous. It becomes just part of every system. It won't be about mapping, it's about geographic understanding and decisions being made in it. It has the potential to help people route roads appropriately, to plan things better, to balance up the various conflicting things that we face as a society. And its potential to be to harm as well, so we have to moderate that. That's our responsibility. But it will become ubiquitous. And the challenge of the next 10 years is to make use of these tools and these technologies that are now there to take it to that point, to make it easy to use. And then for no other reason than we've just done it, I just want to close on another example of what you can do with mapping. This may not work, but this is a musical map. And this is about using, so we've got some music software here. This is no reason that we just finished this.
DJ again, is it?
Sorry?
DJ again.
Yeah, exactly. Here's some music software that makes sounds, and we have basically hacked the map to make it think it's a keyboard. And then we have generated MIDI information, which is musical information, from your position on the map. So imagine you're partially sighted. When you move your finger around a tablet or a mouse around a screen, you have a sense of positional awareness. And what we want to do is, can we reinforce that, help partially sighted people start interacting with maps? Not, you know, in a different way. That's what we want to try and do. We can do this because the technology's got to the point where we can play with it. We don't need to worry about data capture, we don't need to worry about getting access to transport information. It's just there. And now we can start playing with it. So just quickly, what happens? You go into a polygon, gives you feedback of where you are, you go over a road, and it will do that. This is a scale renderer. I love the fact that our maps have scales as well. So this tells you how many bikes there are, the higher the pitch. So that's basically the bar's bike stance. And if I leave the map by accident, it does that, come back on, does that. And if I hover over a tube station,
green bar,
it tells me the tube station.
Jerry Cross.
And if I, this is the best part. If you go into here and you basically browse for a different sound, so let's go for the subtractor. Let's get the wobblator base. Let's go here, back to our map. How much fun is that? Anyway, the fact is you can do incredible stuff with this stuff. We can start, our next thing is haptic feedback. So as you move the map, it's actually force feedback as well, so you can tell you're in something, and it just reinforces it. We demoed this to an audience last week, thinking that the use case was about, if you use it and you sort of half close your eyes, you actually can, the map becomes much more usable. And now when I use an ordinary map, it's like something's missing. I'm not getting that reinforcement. But the military, some bizarrely, are interested in this because in high stress situations, you don't take information in the same way, and the sound reinforces it. And so we just started seeing people come out with different ideas around it. So the spatial technology can excite people. It can do things with society that we struggle to do now. It can make it a better place, but we have a responsibility to control that. And the technology, which is emerging now, is helping us do it.
Because you're giving us an absolute view of the future, although also I think telling us the future is coming so fast it's not going to be the future for very long. So I'm sure there are questions. Who's going to start off? Go on, Robin.
Thanks, John. That's great. In some ways, you rewrote history at the start, so I'd like to correct you on the history.
Sure.
In 78, we created the world's first land information system here in Edinburgh for Switzerland and Germany. Lots of graphics. So it was possible then.
It was.
Yeah. And we also, in 84, we created the world's first relational database, GIS, and lots of other things. Yes. But we were not successful. You're right, because of technology, because of lack of capacity development, probably not marketing ourselves correctly. So it was successful to a degree, but there's huge limitations around that.
So when Slippy Maps became easy on the internet, so you had a map and it loads in the data as you move, that was technically possible 10 years before it happened. GIS industry didn't do it because they were happy with it being slow and wide-spaced. They didn't know that it was public. It was the public who drove that. So it being possible and it happening are two different things.
Correct.
And the thing that concerns me is students being taught about generic data management today are still not learning about the potential of spatial information, even though we did those things in the 70s and 80s. So this problem, you know, the generation of people coming out of Edinburgh University today do not understand what spatial technology can do. That's a concern, and that's a failure of us.
That's a great preamble. My question to you is about the future of GIS. And the question is ESRI the future of GIS worldwide? We see Facebook, we see Google defending territory by any startup gets slowed up, competition taken away.
Yep.
Your thoughts about the future of the landscape when it comes to GIS and ESRI?
So ESRI, obviously a private business, been around for 40 years, owned by a man and his wife, who want to do spatial stuff and focus on it. And we have seen multiple waves of competition and it becoming mainstream. So recently, Google, for example, have taken geography way beyond what people imagined it was. Microsoft are doing a lot of work with it. The connected car type stuff, so car companies, Uber bought a mapping company recently. I think elements of GIS will go completely mainstream. However, both Google and Microsoft, if you see the last Monday's presentation, have come to ESRI to ask for the enterprise GIS support. They've actually tried to do that technology, found it too hard, and the thing, the difference about the GIS industry, and I don't just mean ESRI, I mean the open source community, I mean the few remaining GIS focus, is they focus on that problem. And if we're successful, we will continuously be doing ourselves out of jobs. Things that we used to make money from will become mainstream. I think GIS and geographic science is going to keep advancing, and that's where ESRI and others will play. So we will always have that. Because we focus just on GIS, we will still be there and be feeding that wider machine. But success for me is if we do ourselves out of a job. I just think it's going to take a long, long time.
Another question. Mike.
I was wondering where your thoughts and standards are fitting. Because when we were doing parallel GIS in 1992.
Quite a long time ago, yes.
Especially. We were trying to anticipate where the standards were going, and the open GIS came along. So, firstly, are you working always with those standards? And secondly, where do you think those standards are going now?
So, first of all, because mainstream GIS has developed without spatial, if you need to work with any sort of business at all using IT, you have to be able to interact with those systems. In open standards, proprietary standards, whatever, you just have to be able to interact with the system. So if we didn't do that, if we didn't interact with every database vendor, every open standard, every closed standard, we would be a niche player. We would not be in business in the way we are. So that's fundamental, the ability to work with all those standards. When it comes to standards themselves, there are good standards and there are bad standards, and there are used standards, which are the only ones that matter. So, for example, there's a standard called INSPIRE. It has the force of law behind it, European law, UK law. It's mandated for every government body of a certain size, publishing certain data, to make the INSPIRE standard work. However, it's one of the worst standards I have ever seen. It's close to unusable, it's very ununderstandable, and it's barely used. So in Scotland, there's an INSPIRE portal, and we're fairly convinced the only people who use it are the people who wrote it, testing it. We don't see vast use beyond it. At the same time, we're seeing an explosion of use of GeoJSON, which is not an official standard or anything else. It's something that's grown up on the internet, using JSON format, put into your repository, and there's so many script kiddies out there working with it that it's becoming a standard. So we have to support them, we've got to be able to work with everyone. The only standards we particularly care about are the ones that are used. That's where our focus is. However, having said that, we maintain a team of 60 people just on OGC.
Other questions?
It's kind of related. What message of fitting GIS into a browser and using browser tech? You don't necessarily control the tech that's in the browser.
Do you want to expand on that? Are you asking security questions?
Security. I was thinking sort of long term, because you're not controlling the path of the standards, but you're relying on the browser.
Let's talk about it over beer.
Any other questions?
We're going, Robin, go for another one.
Your main comment is about the usability of GIS. And we've failed in the past to make it intuitive, easy to use, and become just a normal part of this decision making at the highest level. What stopped us doing this, do you think? I know the suite was there and these are nice ideas. When do things become so intuitive that it's just used?
I think, look at the internet of 1992. It was ugly and it was unusable in many ways. And now it's pretty. Can be still unusable, but it's a lot prettier. I think we were so busy solving the IT that we didn't concentrate on that. So we employed a UX person about 4 years ago, which tells you something. Our first user experience person we employed was 4 years ago, and he drew this diagram for us. And he said, first of all, technology has got to be useful, then it's got to be usable, and then it's got to be beautiful. And in that order, we know that GIS is useful. We can stop here for a long, long time. That's my point.
True.
So, a lot of our engineering over the last few years, we've just done a thing called geoanalytics, which is using big data tools to do geographically focused analytics. And we took all of our traditional type analytics, we saw which ones would work in this way, so aggregation, buffering, hotspot analysis, about 25 different standard algorithms, and we put them into this big data world. And at the same time, we engineered every single one of them to be time-enabled as well. So we were doing time-enabled viewing, time-enabled query. And we now have a rule that we basically won't do analysis without that time dimension. And we won't do viewing without that ability to it. We're currently capturing Landsat data, and we're moving towards almost having a daily updated map. If it doesn't have the concept of time and the easy ability to go through it, it's not the value it should have. So that time enablement and then the access to the historic data as part of that, I just see as just being vital and normal and becoming easier once again. Does that answer it? Over beer.
Still a question somewhere.
Go
on, Ian.
Going back to your Squirrel Road
example,
the Squirrel data information was open data, you said, potentially.
Yes.
How does everyone get awareness of all these pieces of open data?
So when I was drawing that thing, the planning application, and it pulled in the data saying there's red squirrels here. The key to making GIS accessible and usable is to not try and do everything, is to publish contextually aware things. So this is the workflow you're trying to do, and this is the task. That task, the person authoring it, needs to know what data sets could be available or what type of data sets. The internet itself provides a platform for gathering the information. So it's more about the people authoring it need to know their business. They need to be experts, and they need to understand what sort of sources of data they have. The wiring is in place. So it's really about someone being aware of the nature of the data available. I think you can find it. More tricky is the analysis of that data that makes sense of it. And that's the part we're trying to develop. So that thing where we're running analysis as you move, we're now trying to find people like the Center for Ecology and Hydrology who can codify what they do to analyze the shapes and publish that as part of the map data as well, not just the data, but that understanding. So we're building a framework that allows you to codify the analysis and publish it in a way where other people can benefit with it without being experts.
Your demo there was in the cozy confines of an area with a very good broadband connection.
Yes.
But probably it's got some greater benefits from actually being used outside the wider world, where, of course, it's not going to always be able to depend on a good...
What I showed you works entirely offline. Yeah. Another thing that we wrote a web-based application, and about a year ago, somebody came up with a way of taking that JavaScript code, that website, and just running it offline, as if it's online.
Right.
And we package the data up and we just push it out. It works offline, no problem. That would not be possible 2 years ago. Absolutely, it's fine. And we run it over. I live in the countryside near Edinburgh. It even works at my house.
I'm going to take it to my house.
It's a challenge accepted.
Are we at a close? I'm going to throw one in. I'm sort of standing here thinking, agonizing about the sort of technology-driven versus problem-driven versus data-driven, and you've kind of shown us a lot of really nice technological solutions to some real problems. But I guess my concern is where the drivers are coming from. You're primarily a technology company, but you're presumably working with customers who are giving you problems.
Yeah, but I think the point is that we had to really focus on technical problems because they were genuine technical barriers. They're falling away rapidly. So we actually, if you look at the profile of people we employ in Azure UK as a sort of guide, we're actually starting to employ GIS people, which we didn't. We used to employ VB programmers and C++ programmers as the majority of our staff. The majority of our intake in the last 4 years has been people with GIS focus and spatial understanding. So we're turning back to a GIS company and moving away from that technical focus. And their job is to go out with customers, and they don't need to worry about can it work, they don't need to worry about how it scales, because we know that problem's been solved. They need to worry about what the customer wants to do. And that to me is the most exciting thing happening at the moment. The very fact that we started employing... I used to come to your session here and tell the students, if you want to do GIS, don't work with us, go to one of our customers. Now we want GIS people, really, really want, because we need that spatial understanding. That to me is the exciting thing right now. So yeah, I enjoy technology. Our job is to solve problems with technology, but we're now at the point where we can focus on doing GIS.
Sounds great. Sounds like a great place to stop, knowing that those of you who are students are going to get jobs, which is CVs at the ready. Okay, I think just before I finally thank Charles, thank you all for coming. It's been great attendance this first seminar. There are others, but not every week. They're every 2 or 3 weeks. So check the website out as to when the next talk is. Do come along. There, I think, is still refreshments at the back, so recharge your glasses before you go. We are heading, and Charles is coming over to the library bar, so if you want to carry on the conversation, carry on the discussions, certainly come and do that. Thank you much to you all. Thank you particularly to Charles. I think Charles has given us a really good talk this afternoon. He's really opened eyes and made us feel valuable, actually, which is a really nice way to feel. So for that alone, Charles, thank you very much.